Welcome back, our fellow patriots, to the Patriot Lessons American History and Civics podcast. I'm Judge Michael Warren. In this episode, we continue our review of Article 1 of the Constitution. We have completed our examination of Sections 1 through 4 of Article 1, and now we move on to explore Section 5, which addresses congressional elections and the internal organization and management of the Congress. When I say we, I'm joined by Mike Gerard and bombastic Brent Bassett, and spectacular Sheila Guerin and enchanting Aaron Mercino. Thank you for all your support. Please subscribe and encourage your fellow patriots and anyone interested in the Constitution to do the same. When we return, Mike Gerard will get us started.
As we previously discussed, the first article of the Constitution establishes the Congress. Sections 1 through 4 of that article establish the two houses of Congress, how the members of each chamber are chosen, the qualifications of and terms of office for the House of Representatives and the Senate, who sets the rules for congressional elections, and the requirement that Congress meet at least once every year. Section 5 also addresses elections, but in a very different way.
Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members.
This clause provides that each chamber of the Congress will determine who is properly entitled to be seated in its respective chamber. As we've also discussed in prior episodes, a committee of the Federal Constitutional Convention prepared a first draft of the Constitution, which was released in a report on August 6th. This report provided language identical to the final constitutional provision. There was no meaningful discussion of this provision at the Constitutional Convention or even the ratification debates. United States Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, an early giant of constitutional law, explained the rationale for the provision as follows. The powers are common to all the legislative bodies of the states, and indeed to those of other free governments. They seem indispensable to the due independence and efficiency of the body. The power to judge the elections, returns, and qualifications of the members of each house must be lodged somewhere, for otherwise any intruder or usurper might assume to be a member. It can be safely lodged in no other body but that in which the party claims a seat, for otherwise its independence, its purity, and even its existence might be under the control of a foreign authority. In other words, someone has to be the final decision maker on who won the election and is qualified to serve in the Congress. And the practice in the states and other countries was that the respective legislative bodies would make that decision. It seems a bit odd, but that is the most practical way to make such a decision. Also, as Justice Story points out, if the congressmen and women don't control access to their respective chambers, then some other outside agency, like the president, the Supreme Court, or something else, could dominate the Congress, and that could be a very dangerous situation.
If I can interject here, I have a somewhat personal experience with this. My first longtime job after I graduated from the University of Michigan Law School was a clerkship of Justice Dorothy Comstock Riley of the Michigan Supreme Court. I won't go into all the details, but a few years before I was blessed with the job, she had been appointed to the Supreme Court, and then her appointment was challenged. And then the Supreme Court, her colleagues, quickly threw her off the court, finding that her appointment was improper. This is a parallel experience of a government body deciding who could serve in the government body. I have to say, Justice Riley soon returned to the bench in an election by defeating one of the justices who tossed her off the court, and she later became Chief Justice. In addition, the Supreme Court later reversed the case that kicked her off. But we should get back to the Constitution.
Wow, I almost forgot that story about Justice Riley. Good job, Judge Warren. Thanks for that interesting detour. Now, applied to Congress, if there's a controversy about who won a particular Senate election, for example, and two people showed up to claim the seat, the Senate would decide who should be seated. Or, for example, someone tried to take office as a member of the House of Representatives and her eligibility for the office was challenged, let's say she was too young or lived in New York but was elected in California, it would be up to the House of Representatives to decide if that challenge was valid and refuse to seat her. And so the next provision of the Constitution provides,
and a majority of each House of Congress shall constitute a quorum to do business.
Similar to the authority of each House to determine the qualifications of its own members, this provision was nearly identical to the proposal issued in Article 6, Section 3 of the August 6th report. But this provision did garner some thoughtful discussion at the convention. On August 10th, Massachusetts delegate Nathaniel Gorham opposed the provision of requiring a majority of each House to constitute a quorum because a
great delay might happen in business and great inconvenience from the future increase of numbers.
In other words, he was concerned that as the number of members of Congress grew, it would take too long to gather a quorum, delaying congressional business. Maryland delegate John Francis Mercer was eager to respond. A prominent lawyer, planter, and land investor, Mercer came from an influential family. His half-brother, Captain John Fenton Mercer, was killed by Native Americans and scalped during the French and Indian War, and two of his other half-brothers served in Virginia's House of Burgesses. Constitutional delegate John Francis Mercer fought in the American Revolution, was wounded at the Battle of Brandywine, and became an aide-de-camp to General Charles Lee. He also served with Lafayette, including at Yorktown. James served in the Virginia House of Delegates and the Continental Congress for 2 years and then became a judge. After the Constitutional Convention, he served in the Federal House of Representatives and as governor of Maryland. And here, he wanted a quorum below a majority of members because
so great a number will put it in the power of a few by seceding, that is leaving, at a critical moment to introduce convulsions and endanger the government. Examples of secession have already happened in some of the states. I am for leaving it to the legislature to fix the quorum as in Great Britain, where the requisite number is small and no inconvenience has been experienced.
When Mercer is referring to secession, he doesn't mean that the states would leave the Union like during the Civil War, but he did mean that congressmen could simply stop showing up to work. And that would paralyze Congress if the required quorum wasn't met. Virginia delegate George Mason, on the other hand, was highly skeptical of lowering the quorum threshold. He rose to oppose Mercer and Gorham. In fact, he argued that
this is a valuable and necessary part of the plan. In this extended country, embracing so great a diversity of interests, it would be dangerous to the distant parts to allow a small number of members of the two houses to make laws. The central states could always take care to be on the spot, and by meeting earlier than the distant ones, or wearying their patience and outstaying them, could carry such measures as they pleased. I admit that inconveniences might spring from the secession of a small number, but I had also known good produced by an apprehension of it. I had known a paper omission prevented by that cause in Virginia. I think the Constitution is now molded, was founded on sound principles, and was disposed to put into it extensive powers. At the same time, I wish to guard against abuses as much as possible. If the legislature should be able to reduce the number at all, it might reduce it as low as it pleased, and the United States might be governed by a junta. A majority of the number which had been agreed on was so few that I feared it would be made an objection against the plan.
Simply put, Mason thought that unless the quorum provision was expressly in the Constitution, that a small clique of congressmen could take control of the legislature and would undermine the Republic. The country would be ruled by a handful of men. This would subvert the whole point of a republic, and was such an obvious flaw that it would be great ammunition to oppose the Constitution. Still, Delegate Rufus King argued that was not such a risk as to overweigh the advantage of allowing business to be conducted with a lower number of members. The loquacious and keenly minded Virginia delegate, Governor Morris, moved to fix the quorum at 33 members in the House of Representatives and 14 in the Senate. He explained, "Fix the number low and they will generally attend, knowing advantage may be taken in their absence. The secession of a small number ought not to be suffered to break a quorum. Such events in the states may have been of little consequence. In the national councils, they may be fatal. Besides other mischiefs, if a few can break up a quorum, they may seize a moment when a particular part of the continent may be in need of immediate aid to extort by threatening a secession some unjust and selfish measure." Delegate John Francis Mercer seconded the motion. What was interesting about this proposal was that Governor Morris was willing to require a quorum to be a majority for the first Congress, but as the number of congressmen increased, which was inevitable, the floor would not rise with the number of congressmen. Massachusetts Delegate Rufus King remarked that he was preparing a similar motion, and that as the number of congressmen increased, he thought requiring a majority of the growing Congress would be extremely cumbersome. The opponents of an outright majority required to be a quorum thought that it would allow for great mischief and created an obstacle to getting the people's work done. This position raised the ire of Connecticut Delegate Oliver Ellsworth. Ellsworth was instrumental in brokering the Great Compromise that determined how senators would be chosen. He would later serve as one of Connecticut's first U.S. senators and would become the third Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Here, he rose in adamant opposition to lowering the threshold for a quorum, arguing that the ability of Congress to set the ratio of the number of representatives would eliminate any concerns regarding having too many members required to create a quorum. In other words, because Congress determines the number of people each member of the House of Representatives represents, the Congress could keep the number small enough to ensure that the people's business would be attended to, while also ensuring that the majority of the people would be represented when the House met to conduct business. James Wilson concurred. Massachusetts Delegate Elbridge Gerry was concerned that a small number of states could dominate Congress if the quorum requirement was set too low. He suggested that the quorum be set between 33 and 50 and allow the Congress to set the exact number. Rufus King agreed, but Maryland Delegate Daniel Carroll opposed the idea, noting that even when the quorum minimum ought to be raised, there was no guarantee that threshold would be moved by the Congress and President. The motion to change the report's recommendation was defeated, and that ended the debate at the Constitutional Convention, and a quorum of a majority of members would be required to conduct business. But the provision would be attacked by the Anti-Federalists. Now, not because the number was too high, which was the main focus of the Constitutional Convention, but because it was too low. Anti-Federalist writer Brutus, who likely was New York Judge John Yates, wrote perhaps the most compelling attacks against the proposed Constitution. Like the pro-ratification Federalist papers, he wrote a series of essays. Echoing George Mason's argument at the convention, Brutus's third essay, published on November 11, 1787, attacked the quorum provision as allowing a small cabal to run the country, which would open up Congress to corruption.
"The House of Representatives would not only be an imperfect representation, but there would be no security in so small a body against bribery and corruption. A quorum will consist at first of 65, and can never exceed one for every 30,000 inhabitants. A majority of these, that is 33, are a quorum, and a majority of which, or 17, may pass any law. A majority of the Senate, or 14, are a quorum, and 8 of them can pass any law. So that 25 men will have the power to give away all the property of the citizens of these states. What security, therefore, can be there for the people, where their liberties and property are at the disposal of so few men? It literally will be a government in the hands of the few to oppress and plunder the many. You may conclude with a great degree of certainty that it, like all others of a similar nature, will be managed by influence and corruption, and that the period is not far distant when this shall be the case, if it should be accepted. For even now there are some among us whose characters stand high in the public estimation and have had principal agency in drafting this Constitution, who do not scruple to say that this is the only practical mode of governing a people, who think that the degree of freedom with which Americans do, this government will have in their gift a vast number of offices of great honor and emolument. The members go to the legislature, are not excluded from appointments, and 25 of them, as the case may be, being secured, any measure may be carried.
Brutus's assessment of the men who were to take power was pessimistic, to say the least. The Congress could not be trusted with power if only a small number would constitute a quorum. They would be easily bribed and oppress the people. The federal government would dole out offices, and the corrupt quorum would simply perpetuate a system of self-serving enrichment for the ruling class. Wow. But the Federalist press did not let these charges go unanswered. Tench Coxe was originally a loyalist who joined the British forces and had been taken prisoner of war. This prompted his change of loyalty, and he joined the revolutionary forces. He attended the Annapolis Convention and served in the Continental Congress. After the Constitution was ratified, he served as an Assistant Secretary of Treasury and Commissioner of Revenue. On May 21, 1788, he wrote a letter addressed to the Virginia Constitutional Convention arguing that the quorum rule was simply the embodiment of Republican representative principles.
Objections have been made by some very respectable gentlemen of your state to the power of Congress, under the new federal constitution, to regulate trade by a bare majority. In a free government, the voice of the people expressed by the votes of a majority must be the rule, or we shall be left without any certain rule to determine what is politically right. To part from it is establishing tyranny by law. It would be a solemn renunciation of the forms and substance of liberty, and our affairs on this dangerous principle must readily hasten to an oligarchy, the most dreadful of all governments.
Coxe turned the anti-federalist arguments around. Without the quorum rule, there would definitely be an anti-democratic oligarchy that would rule by a tyranny of law. The quorum rule was key to preserving liberty. Justice Joseph Story, in his widely cited and wildly popular Commentaries on Constitutional Law, gave a practical reason for the wisdom of the provision. It is equally important that a proper quorum for the dispatch of business should be fixed. Otherwise, a cunning or industrious minority might, by stratagem, usurp the functions of the majority and the laws at their pleasure. On the other hand, if a smaller number were not authorized to adjourn from day to day or to compel the attendance of other members, all legislation might be suspended at the pleasure of the absentees, and the legislature itself be virtually dissolved. Thus, the quorum rule struck the perfect balance. It required enough members to ensure that no small cabal could take control, but did not require so many members as to hopelessly stall legislation and paralyze congressional action for a lack of quorum. The next clause is as follows, and Judge Warren will repeat the first part of the provision to place it in full context.
Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. But a smaller number may adjourn from day to day, and may be authorized to compel the attendance of absent members in such manner and under such penalties as each house may provide.
Almost completely neglected on the convention floor, the state ratifying conventions, and the debates in the convention was the basic legislative authority for a number smaller than a quorum to adjourn the Congress from day to day, which allows it to limp along, and they can order other members to appear to create a quorum if necessary to conduct business. How this is done is totally up to each house. It is an essential part of the internal workings of the Congress. it makes sure that a quorum can be eventually gathered. But it was hardly the stuff of major constitutional controversy. For those of you who have watched C-SPAN and witnessed a senator or representative making a statement to a nearly empty chamber, now you know how this can happen. A quorum is called in the morning, a bunch of folks soon leave, a skeleton crew sticks around, members address the nearly empty chamber, the chamber is adjourned by the few people in attendance at the end of the day, and then it can start up again the next morning when a new quorum will be gathered. And now, bombastic Brent Bassett, would you like to take the next provision?
Most obliged, Mike Gerard. The next provision of Section 5 provides...
Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings.
This provision was also born out of the August 6th report. In fact, it is the same exact verbiage in the August 6th report. This provision was not controversial and generated no material debate at the Constitutional Convention, in the Federalist versus Anti-Federalist debates in the papers, and in the state ratifying conventions. This is interesting. One might think it was readily adopted because it was a carryover from Parliament, but that actually is not true. Pennsylvania Delegate James Wilson explained the historical context in a series of law lectures he gave, a highly regarded constitutional expert, among the most respected in the country. He explained how Parliament had the authority to establish rules for itself.
The Parliament of Great Britain has its peculiar law, a law, says my Lord Coke, with which few are acquainted, but which deserves to be investigated by all. The maxims, however, upon which Parliament proceeds are not, it seems, defined and ascertained by any particular state law. They rest entirely in the breast of Parliament itself. The dignity and independence of the two houses, we're told, are preserved, in a great measure, by keeping their privileges indefinite. Now, very different is the case with regards to the legislature of the United States and that of Pennsylvania. The great maxims upon which our law of Parliament is founded are defined and ascertained in our constitutions.
Remember, in the British Empire, there was no written constitution, and the authority of Parliament had been established between battles, some literally, some figuratively, against the king. Others had simply developed over time. Parliament was supreme and was governed by custom. But in America, the written federal and state constitutions would set the rules. Wilson explained that these constitutions could differ, and he actually believed that the Pennsylvania Constitution was an improvement over the federal provision.
By the Constitution of the United States, each house of the legislature shall be the judge of the qualifications and returns, and also of the elections of its own members. By the Constitution of Pennsylvania, each house shall judge the qualifications of its members, but contested elections shall be determined by a committee to be selected, formed, and regulated in such manner as shall be directed by law. With regard to this subject, the Constitution of Pennsylvania has, I think, improved upon that of the United States. Contested elections, when agitated in the House itself, occasion much waste of time, and, too often, a considerable degree of animosity amongst members. These inconveniences will be, in a great measure, avoided by the proceedings and decision of a committee, directed and governed by a standing law.
Wilson's commentary about how the Pennsylvania and federal constitutions differed is an important lesson in federalism. The state constitutions are not simply duplicates of the federal constitution. They can differ quite significantly, and even where they have parallel provisions, often the state constitutions improve or refine the federal model. In any event, this provision in the federal constitution provides that how the House of Representatives and the Senate operate is entirely up to each chamber. Justice Joseph Story explained the vital practical importance of this constitutional provision.
Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and, with the concurrence of 2/3, expel a member. These powers are usually granted to legislative bodies. If they did not exist, it would be utterly impractical to transact the business of the nation at all, or at least to transact it with decency, deliberation, and order. Without rules, no public body can suitably perform its functions.
The point Story is making is a pretty basic one. When does the House begin the day? How does it end the day? Does the House or Senate have a leadership team? Are there committees? How does legislation get drafted? Are there hearings? If so, how are they scheduled? Who makes those decisions? How does legislation or other business ever come to a vote? Is there a sergeant at arms? Do they take vacations? There are thousands of such questions, and the answers are determined by the House and Senate, respectively. With the rules, the business of each chamber can run efficiently. Without these rules, there would be chaos and no business will be conducted. No one, not the president, not the Supreme Court, not the states, not the people, can dictate to the House and Senate how to organize and manage its business. The next clause of Section 5 provides as follows. Again, for context, Judge Warren will read the entire sentence.
Each House may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of 2/3, expel a member.
Like the other provisions we have discussed, this one was also first addressed in the August 6th report. But the report was actually a bit different. Article 6, Section 6 of the August 6th draft of the Constitution provided.
Each House may determine the rules of its proceedings, may punish its members for disorderly behavior, and may expel a member.
At the Constitutional Convention, the report came under fire immediately. James Madison was the first to speak up. I know, it is hard to believe James Madison would have something to say in a provision he didn't draft. And on August 10th, he pointed out the threshold for expelling members was too low and immediately suggested a very wise amendment. The right of expulsion of Article 6, Section 6 was too important to be exercised by a bare majority of a quorum, and in emergencies of faction might be dangerously abused. I move that, with the concurrence of 2/3, might be inserted between may and expel. Mr. Randolph and Mr. Mason approved the idea. Gouverneur Morris disagreed. A majority vote was just fine with Morris.
This power may be safely trusted to a majority. To require more may produce abuses on the side of the minority. A few men, from factious motives, may keep in a member who ought to be expelled.
Mr. Carroll thought that the concurrence of 2/3, at least, ought to be required. On the question requiring 2/3 agreement in cases of expelling a member, 10 states were in the affirmative, Pennsylvania divided. Article 6, Section 6, as thus amended, was then agreed to unanimously. Several years after ratification, Constitutional Delegate James Wilson explained that, once again, Pennsylvania's Constitution improved on the federal model.
Each House of Congress may not only punish, but with a concurrence of 2/3, it may expel a member. This regulation is adopted by the Constitution of Pennsylvania, but it is added not a second time for the same cause. The reason for the addition, evidently, is that the member who has offended cannot be an object of a second expulsion unless, since the offense given and punished by the first expulsion, he has either been re-elected by his former constituents or elected by others. In both cases, his election is proof that in the opinion of his constituents, he either has not offended at all or has already sufficiently been punished for his offense. The language of each opinion is that he ought not to be expelled again, and the language of the constituents is a law to the House.
Wilson pointed out that theoretically, under the federal constitution, a member of Congress who had been expelled but returned in a future election or through an appointment could be expelled again by the Congress for the same conduct. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, prevents an expulsion based on the same grounds. If a member of Congress is returned by the people or by an appointment, the Pennsylvania legislature would be required to follow that decision. It is kind of like double jeopardy. You can't be punished for the same conduct more than once. Joseph Story also reflected on how this provision provided a superb balance. It allowed the Congress to expel members who had engaged in conduct warranting such a penalty, but made the threshold for exclusion high enough that only members who really deserved the sanction would be expelled. It hedged against an over-domineering political majority from just expelling its political enemies.
If rules are made, they are mere nullities, unless the person on whom they are to operate can be compelled to obey them. But if an unlimited power to punish, even to the extent of expulsion, existed, it might, in factious times, be applied by a domineering majority to get rid of the most intelligent, virtuous, and efficient of their opponents. There is, therefore, a check interposed, which requires a concurrence of 2/3 to expel, and this number can hardly be presumed to concur in exercising the power of expulsion, except in cases of flagrant breaches of the rights of the House.
With the 2/3 threshold of expulsion, the rights of the people to elect their representatives would be secure. But that also allows truly egregious members of Congress to be expelled. The next provision of Article 1, Section 5 ensures that a congressional record, literally, is made.
Each House shall keep a journal of its proceedings, and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. And the yeas and nays of members of the House in any question shall, at the desire of 1/5 of those present, be entered on the journal.
Judge Warren, since you draft these episodes, have written a book, and are working on another book, it only seems appropriate if you cover this provision about creating a journal. Judge Warren? Judge Warren!
Oh, so sorry, Bombastic Brent Bassett. I was trying to catch up on the research for our next episode. But yes, I'd be happy to review this provision. Article 6 of the August 6th draft of the Constitution had a very similar provision. The House of Representatives and the Senate, when acting in a legislative capacity, shall keep a journal of their proceedings, and shall, from time to time, publish them. And the yeas and nays of the members of each House, on any question, shall be at the desire of 1/5 of the members present, be entered on the journal. Notice there are two major changes between the August 6 report and the final Constitution. First, the August 6 report only required a journal for Congress when it was acting in its legislative capacity. Items like appointments and hearings need not be part of the journal. The final constitutional language eliminates that limitation. Second, the August 6 draft did not allow for any secrecy. This would have been problematic in connection with diplomatic matters and intelligence, that is, spying, and similar sensitive topics. The Founding Fathers ultimately determined that such matters should not be matter of public record. James Madison and South Carolina delegate John Rutledge got the ball rolling to modifying the August 6 report when on August 11th they moved.
That each House shall keep a journal of its proceedings and shall publish the same from time to time, except such part of the proceedings of the Senate, when acting not in its legislative capacity, as may be judged by that House to require secrecy.
Notice here that the amendment only applied to the Senate when it was not acting in its legislative capacity. The Senate was expected to take part in appointments of federal office holders and entering treaties, so these duties were to be exempted under the amendment. It seemed that the convention thought that the House of Representatives only had legislative functions, so its proceedings were to be fully recorded. Maryland delegate John Francis Mercer opposed the motion, noting that it implied that Congress would have authority beyond just legislating, which he opposed. Well, in any event, the motion went down in flames, with only Madison's Virginia supporting it. Desiring that journals be published, but sensing that secrecy was still important, Massachusetts Delegate Elbridge Gerry and Connecticut Delegate Roger Sherman banded together to propose that the proceedings be published, except such as relate to treaties and military operations. This would have covered the House of Representatives, too. This proposal also went down in flames. Sherman's fellow Connecticut delegate, Oliver Ellsworth, wondered if the provision was worth the bother. He suggested that Congress should be relied upon to publish something anyway, so maybe the clause should just be defeated. If Congress failed to act, the people would call them into account. James Wilson vigorously opposed Sherman's sentiments.
Expunging of the clause would be very improper. The people have a right to know what their agents are doing or have done, and it should not be in the option of the legislature to conceal the proceedings. Besides, as this is a clause in the existing Articles of Confederation, not retaining it would furnish the adversaries of the reform with a pretext by which weak and suspicious minds may be easily misled.
The work of the Congress, Wilson argued, could not be hidden from the voters. They had a journal under the Articles of Confederation, so they could not go back on that expectation. George Mason concurred, and he responded that not having a constitutionally mandated journal
would give a just alarm to the people to make a conclave of their legislature.
In other words, Congress could just shut the doors and lock the people out. Sherman retorted that the legislature might be trusted in this case, if in any. The convention nevertheless resolved that the Constitution require the Congress to publish the journal. Quickly thereafter, the convention also agreed to add the exception for secrecy. Notice the final constitutional language did not place any kind of restriction on what could be considered necessary for secrecy, but it did require the houses to determine that secrecy was necessary. This allows the maximum flexibility for determining secrecy and also makes each chamber accountable for those decisions. It also aligns with the provision that allows each chamber to set its own rules. There would be a journal, but what went in the journal would be up to Congress. The provision that required the recording of each vote, in other words, a roll call vote, if one-fifth of the respective chamber voted for the same, was apparently uncontroversial. There is no real discussion of the matter on the floor of the convention, the state ratifying conventions, and the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. James Madison addressed the importance of these measures in his lectures on the law, again contrasting the federal constitution to the more recent Pennsylvania constitution, which called for more exacting measures.
The Constitution of the United States directs that each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish them, except such parts as may require secrecy. It further directs that the yeas and nays of the members of either house on any question shall, at the desire of one-fifth of those present, be entered on the journal. The Constitution of Pennsylvania goes still further upon these points. It directs that the journals shall be published weekly, that the yeas and nays shall be entered on them at the desire of any two members, and that the doors of each house and the committees of the whole shall be open, unless when the business shall be such as ought to be kept secret.
The federal constitution leaves it to Congress to determine when the journal of its proceedings should be published and makes no mention about Congress conducting its business in public. The Pennsylvania Constitution, on the other hand, required weekly publication of its journal and literally dictated that the doors of the House and committees generally be open. Although it may seem self-evident today that the work and debates of a representative legislature should be open to the voters was not taken for granted, Wilson elaborated on why it was actually indispensable.
That the conduct and proceedings of representatives should be as open as possible to the inspection of those whom they represent seems to be, in republican government, a maxim of whose truth or importance the smallest doubt cannot be entertained. that, by a necessary consequence, every measure which will facilitate or secure this open communication of the exercise of delegated power should be adopted and patronized by the constitution and laws of every free state, seems to be another maxim, which is an unavoidable result of the former. In the House of Commons, says Sir William Blackstone, the conduct of every member is subject to the future censure of his constituents, and therefore should be openly submitted to their inspection.
Justice Story reiterated the importance of the journal, but also noted that the 1/5 requirement was vital to allowing the efficient administration of Congress's duties.
Each of these provisions has the same object: to ensure publicity and responsibility in all the proceedings of Congress, so that the public mind may be enlightened as to the acts of the members. But cases may exist where secrecy may be indispensable to the complete operation of the intended acts either at home or abroad. And, on the other hand, an unlimited power to call the yeas and nays on every question at the mere will of a single member would interrupt and retard, and in many cases wholly defeat, the public business. In each case, therefore, a reasonable limitation is interposed.
This provision was basically ignored in the state ratifying conventions and by the Anti-Federalists. They had much bigger concerns than the journaling of votes and public access of a Congress they hoped to stop from coming into existence. The last provision of Article 1, Section 5 provides as follows: neither House, during the session of Congress, shall without the consent of the other adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any place than that in which the two Houses shall be sitting. The August 6 report, interestingly, had a similar provision, but it specifically exempted the Senate. Mike Girard, can you tell us how much of a reaction this provision generated within the convention? Mike Girard.
Sorry, Judge. This provision engendered very little comment on the floor of the Constitutional Convention, the State Ratifying Convention, or in the paper wars between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. Apparently, it was not too important.
Whoa, hold on there, big fella. This might not have generated a bunch of debate, but it was very important. In England, the king controlled when the parliament would meet and adjourn, and the president would have no such authority here. The Americans were united in the strong belief that the Congress would independently determine how it would meet. James Wilson explained.
In England, the sole right of convening, proroguing, and dissolving the parliament forms a part, and obviously a very important part, of the prerogative of the king. Here we discover, in our new constitutions, another renovation of the old Saxon customs. The original meetings of the Vidkanagamot in England were held regularly at two seasons of the year, at the end of the spring and at the beginning of autumn. Afterwards, there came to be two sorts of Vidkanagamots, one held by custom and another at stated periods. The other called occasionally, and by a special summons from the king. Under the princes of the Norman and Plantagenet lines, the ancient and regular meetings of the national legislature were more and more disregarded. The consequence was that, in progress of time, the whole of the parliamentary business was transacted in extraordinary meetings, which were called at the pleasure of the sovereign principis obsta, or resist the beginnings, in consequence of acquire the power to call the parliament together, that of putting a negative upon its meeting, in other words, of proroguing or dissolving it, was in all cases vested in the crown.
Witten age moat? Plantagenet lines? Principis obsta? What was that again?
Okay, Wilson got into the weeds there. But the bottom line is that through tradition and custom, the predecessor of the parliament, called the Witkin Agamot, and the modern-day parliament basically called to meet and was dissolved by the king. And the founding fathers? Well, they were going to have none of that.
And don't forget, it requires each chamber of Congress to consent to the other chamber to allow any adjournment. It also prevents them from meeting someplace other than the United States Capitol unless they both agree to meet in the alternative location. This really eliminates all kinds of mischief that could happen. For example, if the Senate decided to adjourn on its own and meet in Anchorage, Alaska. The advantages and importance of these restrictions are pretty obvious. This protects the independence of the Congress and ensures that its two chambers cooperate reasonably to conduct the people's business. In addition, Congress has some other implied powers, which exist simply by the nature of the institution. That is, Congress possesses authority that any legislative body would necessarily possess. Justice Story explains, for example, the authority to hold those committing misconduct in Congress to be held in contempt of Congress.
Other incidental powers may well be presumed to exist. Among these, the power to punish contempts committed against either house by strangers has been generally admitted and insisted upon in practice as indispensable to the freedom, the deliberative functions, and the personal safety of the members. Even the Founding Fathers could not delineate every single power that Congress possesses. Still, by its very nature as a legislative body, Congress has some inherent powers that did not need to be spelled out in the Constitution. Still, despite some reliance on implied and inherent powers, the Founding Fathers did a pretty bang-up job on filling in most of the details.
They sure did, Mike Girard. Some key takeaways from this episode. Each chamber of the Congress is the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its members. A majority of each house is necessary to have a quorum to conduct business. When in session, less than a quorum can adjourn and compel a quorum to sit. Each chamber determines its own rules and can punish members for disorderly behavior and can even expel members with a two-thirds vote. Each house must keep a journal of its proceedings and publish them from time to time, except for such business as requires secrecy, and a roll call vote is necessary if one-fifth of the chamber asks for it. Neither chamber can adjourn without the consent of the other for more than 3 days, and neither chamber can fix a new place to meet without the consent of the other chamber. I am Oakland County Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren and author of America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles in History. Our other two fabulous Patriot narrators are Mike Girard Skonechny, who is our sound designer and Patriot Week's video content producer, and the multi-talented, bombastic Brent Bassett. This podcast is produced by Patriot Week. Please visit Patriot Week's website at patriotweek.org to learn more about America's first principles, key documents and speeches, founding fathers and other great patriots, and flags from our history, along with all the fantastic resources we have to offer. Our fellow patriots, thank you for listening. Until next time, when we continue our exploration of the United States Congress, God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you, our fellow patriots, for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast and rate us. That is, if you're going to give us those 5 golden stars. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms. You can also find much more at patriotweek.org, which includes videos, lesson plans, TV episodes, and many other goodies. Patriot Week is celebrated every year from September 11th, the anniversary of the terrorist attacks, through September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. It has been recognized by the U.S. Senate and many states. Patriot Week was started by then 10-year-old Leah Warren when she pounded on the table and demanded a new celebration of America. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Instagram, or reach out directly at mwarren@patriotweek.org. Also consider Judge Warren's book, America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles and History, by visiting americasurvivalguide.com, Amazon, or any other online retailer. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.